Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I just finished my conversation with Professor Gaurav Desai about his award-winning book, Commerce with the Universe, Africa, India, and the Afro-Asian Imagination, published by Columbia University Press in 2013. In this conversation, we will think about the intersections of literature with that of history and anthropology, among other social sciences and humanities. This conversation has really gave me so many insights about the shared world between East Africa and South Asia, and I hope you will enjoy it too. Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Elmazmi from Princeton University.
And I'm your co-host, Michael Ramore from the City University of New York.
Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Gaurav Desai, the author of the award-winning book, Commerce with the Universe, Africa, India, and the Afro-Asian Imagination, published by Columbia University Press in 2013. A recipient of René Wellick Prize by the American Comparative Literature Association. Gaurav Desai is a professor of English at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. By discussing this book, we will explore the multifaceted literary and cultural worlds between South Asia and East Africa. Welcome, Gaurav, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you.
Can you please start by saying a few words about yourself? That is, where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? How you became interested in your field of study? And if you had any influential mentors?
So I was born in Mumbai, in the 1960s, late 60s. And I grew up there as a child until the age of 13. And then my parents moved to East Africa, and I moved with them to Kenya, to Nairobi in particular. We were in Nairobi for a year and a half, and then my dad got posted to a new job in Dar es Salaam. And so we moved to Dar es Salaam after that, and I did all my high schooling there. And then when I finished high school, I came to the U.S. as an undergraduate student, studied at Northwestern University in Evanston, and I found there a graduate student, Simon Gikandi, who's now the chair of the department of Princeton, Princeton's English department, but he was a graduate student back then at Northwestern, and he kind of took me under his wings. And, since you ask about mentorship, he's been a mentor to me for the past 30 or so years. And I studied African literature with him. I was determined to be an Africanist, not a South Asianist, which is what many post-colonial studies scholars were back then. And so my first book was really on African studies, on Nigeria, on African literature. And I came to this project much later.
Yes, he's an amazing mentor, I can say that. Let's turn to the book. In your book, you ask, what happens to our understanding of Africa, its history, its sense of identity, its engagement with modernity, and the possibilities of its future, if we read its long history as an encounter not only with the West, but also with the East? So how did you become interested in the Indian Ocean world? How did that shape your understanding of Africa?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, when I first came to the States, I was not planning on being a literature major. I was thinking of going to business school or something like that. And then taking courses with Simon, and then also, I must admit, being nostalgic about, you know, and homesick, and being nostalgic about my upbringing, really, as a teenager in East Africa, I went more towards literary studies and African studies and African literature. And the Indian Ocean was not really part of that for me. You know, I distinctly, as I said earlier, distinctly wanted to fashion myself as an Africanist. And what Africanist meant for most of us back then was, you know, Black Africa. It was all about nationalism. You know, it was about working against the legacies of colonialism, British colonialism in particular, in the East African context. So the narratives were always white versus black. They were not the Asian question was not so much was not as central a question. Back in those days. In fact, I remember just when I was an undergraduate, that's when Abdul Jan Muhammad's book on Manichaean aesthetics was published. And it was a major contribution to the field. And it took the Fanonian paradigm of the Manichaean world, you know, divided between black and white in the context of Africa as the paradigm. And it took me several years, even though I had been an Asian in Africa and I had known the community, it took me several years to actually, you know, conceptually understand the complexities of that world, you know, in terms of race relations, in terms of, you know, the different kinds of settlers, if you will. In fact, even in John Muhammad's case, you know, he started off with the Fanonian paradigm of settlers versus natives. And then soon enough, you know, whether consciously or not, in his writing, he started talking about conquerors versus natives. And I read that as a way in which he was coming to terms with the fact that not all settlers were necessarily conquerors, right? Or at least, you know, Indians were settlers too, Asians were settlers too, but they didn't conceive of themselves as conquerors in the way in which one might think of white colonial rule or British colonial rule. So there were nuances there. And it took time for even intellectuals like John Muhammad and then, you know, those of us who came after to come to terms with this, to understand those mixed legacies.
Mm-hmm. Would it be correct to say that the book idea developed in relation to these readings? If you can tell us about that, and what was the research process like and your writing experience?
Right. So, you know, in terms of readings, I think that the two texts that most spoke to me were Vasanji's Gunny Sack and Amitav Ghosh's In an Antique Land. Now, I read the Gunny Sack first. You know, it was the major kind of novel written by an Asian African writer. I mean, there were novels before that, but they didn't have the same kind of magnitude as the Gunny Sack. The Gunny Sack was really earth-shattering in that sense, you know, in its scope, its kind of vast history, its imagination. And I taught the Gunny Sack in classes of African literature. So in other words, not courses that were specifically about Asian Africans, but just, you know, general courses in the African novel. I thought it'd be good to have a variety of perspectives. I always had some white South African writing, for instance, in that course, usually Katsia, but others as well. And I thought it'd be great to have an Asian writer in there. And so I used to teach Gunny Sack. And so that was one marker. The second marker was In an Antique Land by Amitav Ghosh, which really, you know, kind of exploded my world because, you know, most of the work I was doing was contemporary. Most of the work I was doing was 19th and 20th century and now 21st. But, you know, back then, 19th and 20th century. And all of a sudden, here comes a text which says, by the way, think about the continuities. Yes, there are discontinuities as well, but think about the continuities between the world of the 12th century and our contemporary times. And, you know, what are the kinds of things that folks in the 12th century were engaging in terms of exchanges of ideas, of goods, of, you know, of everything, really. I mean, commerce in that larger, wider sense. And think about what, you know, what those legacies mean to us today or what they did to the 19th century and 20th century. So that's what really got me started. Now, again, you know, one one always has to rethink one's own intellectual trajectories. As I said, particularly as a South Asian man, as somebody who identifies as somebody who came from South Asia, I had made a very conscious effort early in my career to not be labeled a South Asianist. I wanted to be an Africanist. And I was doing that as a kind of, you know, statement because I knew at that point, especially post-colonial studies as it was emerging, was heavily dominated by South Asian intellectuals. And I couldn't do anything about the fact that I was a South Asian intellectual. I mean, that's just who I am. I can't change that. But what I could do was to say, look, you know, let's not focus on South Asia and India. Let's focus on other parts of the world that need to be talked about as well in the context of post-colonialism. So I made a very conscious effort in that early stage. And then, you know, this kind of crept up on me. I kept saying, okay, well, even if you're an Africanist, what you're doing is you're forgetting the fact that Africa was not just engaged in this encounter with the West. It had a longer history of an encounter with the East. And, you know, you're going to have to deal with that, and you're going to have to negotiate that, and you're going to understand that. And maybe if you start looking into that carefully, you might find that you become a richer and more engaged Africanist, you know, by doing that. And so I inevitably ended up with that route. Oh, you asked me about the research process. So here's something that might be of interest to you. And this is a plea for any administrators and any funders who are out there who might be listening to this podcast. Research takes time. You know, I spent an entire sabbatical year in which I had no duties to my institution, no teaching obligations, no service. I was on a research leave at the National Humanities Center the entire year of 2001-2002. And it took me that full year to write the chapter on In an Antique Land. So the yield was 34 pages of printed text. And you might say, that's a low yield for a whole year's worth of work. And perhaps it is. I'll let the readers judge that. But it was possibly the most fulfilling year of my academic career. Because what I was able to do in that year was, not only was I able to study the text and, you know, really read it critically and carefully, but I was able to track the over 250 or so footnotes that Ghosh has in that book. And I actually could not just track them, but I actually read through them, at least the ones that were in English. I couldn't read the ones in Hebrew, but I could read the ones in English. And I read through every single one of the references that he had. That takes time. You know, that takes time. I read through thousands of pages of Guyton's Levant Mediterranean Society books. And I should also say, you talk about the research process. It was fortuitous in some ways, because it was 2001 and September 11th had just happened. 9/11 had just happened. And, you know, much as we are right now, that was a time of anxiety. It was a time of pain. It was a time of, you know, needing to feel that one needed to be healed. And, you know, the world of the land, the 12th century world that Ghosh presents in an antique land was my escape. That's the way in which I said, okay, the world is falling apart now. But back then, there was a time at which, you know, Muslims and Jews could work together, could live together in harmony, all the conflicts that seem to descend upon us today, there were different answers to, there were different solutions to it. That was my starting point, by the way. And so it was escapist in the best and worst possible way to work with that text. And of course, as you know, you've read the book. As I worked on that chapter, I realized the nostalgic impulse, which I engaged in myself. But I also realized that nostalgia needed to be tempered. That, you know, that there were ways in which Ghosh's presentation of that world, while, you know, something that I completely supported and something that I continue to admire greatly, you know, also had its bits of, blindness, also had its bits of excesses that needed to be corrected. And throughout the chapter, I tried to correct for them. You know, I say, well, you know, yes, Indian Ocean slavery is different from transatlantic slavery, but let's not fall into the error of romanticizing it. Yes, it's true that, you know, the invasion, the incursion of Europeans in the Indian Ocean world with the arrival of the Portuguese led to more conflict-ridden Indian Ocean spaces. But let's not pretend that everything before was just, just love and peace, because it wasn't.
Thank you for sharing the research experience and your extensive readings. That made me think about the book in the sense that it draws on both fictional and non-fictional sources. So for someone like me who's trained in history and anthropology, I often think, where do you see the paths of literary studies cross with that of history and anthropology?
Yeah, you know, here also I think a bit of personal narrative might help. When I was an undergrad, of course, I was both an English major, but also an African studies major. And African studies, as like all area studies, as you know, is interdisciplinary. And I was taking courses in history, anthropology, and other fields. When I went to grad school, ironically, I found myself, even though I was in an English department at Duke, it was a great experience as a graduate student, but I found myself drawn more towards the lectures, you know, and visiting guest speakers and all in the anthropology department more than anything else. I went to the ones in English, but the ones that really excited me were the ones that were in the anthropology department. And maybe this has something also to do with the fact that even when I was an undergraduate, having done the African studies stuff, I was also a student of Dwight Conkergood's and Margaret Drewell's, who taught in the performance studies department at Northwestern. And performance studies in its Northwestern guise was very heavily influenced by the work of people like Clifford Geertz and Victor Turner. And so I had a lot of that training in me, which I took to my project, and I've always taken to my project. In fact, my first book, Subject to Colonialism, didn't have a single literary reading of a literary text. All the texts I read in that book were historical texts or anthropological texts. I mean, I brought the skills of a literary critic to those texts, but they were not. I was not reading novels in them. I was not reading fiction or poetry or anything like that. So I've always found that interdisciplinary angle useful. I think that in that first text, Subject to Colonialism, I worked with, for instance, just to give you an example, I worked with a text by Akiga Sai, a TIV man, Nigerian TIV man, a text that had been used by historians many times, but it had been used as data. They had just mined it for historical information. They had never read Akiga as a historical figure in his own rights, as a historical narrator in his own rights, as a subject of creating history. They just went to the text for, Akiga confirms our sense of the active history because he says, you know, such and such happened on such and such a time. But they never looked at his narrative, right? And so that's what I did as a literary critic. I went to the historians and I said, look, let's read this historical text as a narrative of its own. And I think, some people found that of interest. This is now old hat. I mean, everybody does this now. But back then when I was doing it, it was, still relatively new in African historical studies. So in any case, again, Amitav Ghosh is a wonderful example here. I mean, the guy was trained as an anthropologist, and he's become, he uses that training to write fiction, to write essays, to write nonfiction. There's real, I think the best work is fluid, is fluid between these various disciplines. Here at the University of Michigan, where I teach, there's a wonderful program that, is a graduate program which crosses over between anthropology and history. And it has produced, I think, some of the most interesting minds out there, some of the leading scholars in African studies, but also other studies, where, the best practices of anthropologists and historians, and by the way, literary critics and other fields are brought together. So that's what I would say.
Great. What is your assessment of the literary and cultural studies of diasporic literature in the Indian Ocean? And what can your study of South Asian cultural production in East Africa tell us about the potential of this field for Indian Ocean world studies and its many diasporas?
So by diasporic studies, I just want to just get a clarification. By diasporic literature, do you mean literature of, let's say, the South Asian diaspora or?
Really any diaspora within this vast,
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there is a great future. I think some of the most interesting work that I'm beginning to see is work that is done with the various, languages that circulate in the Indian Ocean. So my work, some of it was written in, in Gujarati, for instance, but a lot of it has been translated. And I, even though I can, I can follow Gujarati, most of it I read in translation and I worked with in translation. But there are scholars now who are well-versed in the various languages that circulate in the Indian Ocean, who are working with those, with the literatures that are being produced in those languages. And I think that and have been for millennia. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. They have been in, for a long time. And I find that's going to be the most interesting and refreshing work that's going to be, that we're going to be looking at. I always worry though, because as you know, and I'm sure we'll get to this later when we come to some of the specific texts that I looked at in my book as well. As we know, the circulation and publication of scholarship also depends on, unfortunately, depends, on metropolitan values. Oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes. And so, if publishers think that there is not enough of a market for, publishing books on, let's say, Gujarati language literature, in the Indian Ocean, scholars are going to have a tough time producing it. Now, the good part of this is that, of course, now we have more open access avenues of publication. We have the internet. We have other means of disseminating this scholarship. But then again, as you both know, we also have to change the structures of the academy to recognize that work as work that can, lead to tenure and the various other awards and rewards that the academy has to offer. So those are some of the barriers. But at the same time, I'm very hopeful for this work. I think there's a lot more that's coming.
Mm-hmm. I really found your book interesting and really productive to think about how the Indian Ocean in many ways have been, stereotyped as a model for certain things. So in what ways does your disruption of stereotyped immigrants and local groups like South Asians in East Africa or the local Africans in diasporic literature help us think of alternative ways for accessing social and historical experiences in Indian Ocean exchanges?
Yeah, so the question of stereotypes, this was really, an important thing for me to think through, because as I say in the book, the Asian in the context of East Africa, but in Africa in general, is always thought of as, the dukawala, the shopkeeper, the trader. And to be sure, a lot of Indians went to East Africa as traders and shopkeepers. Many of them, at least in the context of East Africa, went as indentured laborers to build the railway. But they were engaged in all kinds of professions and all kinds of trades, including, I might add, as we know from people like Mamdani, some became academics. And yet, the stereotype of the dukawala retains. So, just to take the example of the academic, right? There is a case in point that I like to think of. There was a book published in 1956, as early as 1956, by an Indian academic called Ramakrishna Mukherjee. And he wrote a book called Uganda and an Historical Accident, Class, Nation, and State Formation. Right? The book was later republished in 1985 by Africa World Press, many years later. But what's interesting to me about that book is that when you reread that book, from 1956, you can see that it anticipates in many ways many of the discussions that we later associate with people like Hobsbawm and Ranger. The notion of the invention of ethnicity, or the critiques of the term tribalism. Now, these are, as all Africanists know, these are commonplace critiques and understandings in African studies. You know, if we say invention of ethnicity, we know exactly what that is. We know the kind of intellectual genealogy of it. But that genealogy traces to Hobsbawm and Ranger, right? It doesn't trace back to Ramakrishna Mukherjee, who actually, in fact, was doing that work in 1956. Now, why might that be? I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why that might be, including, again, as I was saying earlier, access to those publications, the circulation of those that publication, etc. But I also think it partly has to do with the fact that, the world of African studies, for the most part, with a few exceptions like, you know, early exceptions like Issa Shivji and Mahmoud Mamdani, has really been carved between white and black academics. Indians or Asians have never really been thought of as, major speakers on the Africanist landscape when it comes to scholarship. And yet, what we know is that, you know, there were scholars both in East Africa as well as in India who were engaged in Africanist scholarship, right from the beginning. India holds all kinds of archives that are useful to Africanists to look at. In fact, I've spent a lot of time in the Maharashtra State Archives in Mumbai, both for this project as well as related projects. And I found material there that Africanists in the West have not necessarily been able to access because their points of reference are usually the British archives or the various national archives in the East African spaces, which are great, which are wonderful, but they don't capture everything that's possibly out there. UNESCO put out a book a few years ago on archives of interest to Africanists that are located in India. And that's a two-volume book, you know. So there's a lot of information, there's a lot of material out there that is not being accessed. And again, it goes back to, you know, the fundamental premises that we have about who's an Africanist or sources of legitimacy and so forth.
Thanks. So I think that's a great segue to turn to the book and its chapters. So Commerce with the Universe, Africa, India, and the Afrasian Imagination consists of 7 chapters and a coda. Let's just get into it. So we'll start with chapter 1, titled Ocean and Narration. So in this introductory chapter, you argue that Indian Ocean narratives have often relied on a static conception of the African continent, one where Africa provides something of an immobile backdrop for the diasporic mobility of South Asian and Arab subjects. So why do you think it's been so difficult to narrate the Indian Ocean as an African diasporic space specifically?
You know, I think that the best answer to that question actually comes from not me, but from Achille Mbembe. And I quote Achille in that introductory chapter, in which what he says is that one of the problems around this is that I'll just read out a little bit of that quote so that you can get the flavor of it. He says, racial and territorial authenticity are conflated, and Africa becomes the land of black people. Since the racial interpretation is at the foundation of a restricted civic relatedness, everything that is not black is out of place and thus cannot claim any sort of Africanity. And yet, he continues, the repertoires on the basis of which the imaginaries of race and symbolism of blood are constituted have always been characterized by their extreme variety. At a level beyond that of simple black-white opposition, other racial cleavages have always set Africans against each other. And here may be enumerated not only the most visible, black Africans versus Africans of Arab, South Asian, Jewish, or Chinese ancestry, but also a range of others that can attest to the panoply of colors and then annexation to projects of domination. And he lists a whole bunch, including Berbers, Tuaregs, Afro-Brazilians, Fulanis, etc., etc. So the point that Bembe is making is that in the context of the anti-colonial struggle and the anti-colonial project against white colonialism, whether it was British, French, or whatever, apartheid, South Africa, etc., oftentimes, and for good reason, the narrative was constructed as a binary. Right, it was white versus black, and many times black included, Asians and other people of color. It was a moment of solidarity. So, it was not always perfect. There were internal you know, there were internal conflicts and tensions. Some Asians might not have fully signed on to the Black nationalist narrative. Others might have. So that we talk, I talk about some of that in the book. But the stark, if you want to put it, in kind of like a stark, blunt way, the fight against colonialism was a fight against white supremacy versus a whole coalition of folks who were, loosely structured, loosely framed as Black, if you will. Okay, fine. It was a necessary moment, and that was done, right? What happened, though, is that that narrative, ultimately over time, could not quite take into terms once at least formal structural colonialism was over, could not quite take into terms the various different kinds of identities that Achille Mbembe points out that were already in existence and already prevalent on the African continent for many years, even during colonialism. That included, Arabs, that included South Asians, that included Chinese Africans, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. And so that's where I think, the difficulties were. The second difficulty, I think, was not just that overwhelming narrative, which, as I say, and I continue to say, was an important and necessary narrative, in the struggle against colonialism. But the other thing that I think we should also keep in mind is that there was a justifiable reaction to any sort of narrative that looked at African progress or African history as being something that arrived from elsewhere. Very good reason, right? Because that was what the colonial narrative was all about. It was about, Africa was in stasis and we brought civilization to Africa, right? We white folks, basically civilized Africa. That was the underwriting narrative of colonialism. So if you even had a hint which suggested that there might have been exchange of ideas, of commerce, of culture, of anything that came from outside of Africa to the continent, that was always read with suspicion. That was always read against this overarching framework of civilizational, narrative. So you couldn't really, there was no space really for looking to the East for those kinds of, for any sort of, narrative of exchange. The narrative had to be centering Africa and centering Black Africa. That was the need. That was the emergent kind of narrative. And so in that context, looking outwards towards the Indian Ocean was not a priority. And again, rightly so. Fully understandable. It was not a priority. But as time has moved on, as we go further and further away from those colonial narratives, there are now more spaces opened up to think about those multiple levels of exchange.
Yeah, and it seems like those issues of solidarity and cleavage link to your discussion of Indian Ocean cosmopolitanism, that keyword in chapter 2, which is titled Old World Orders, Amitav Ghosh and the Writing of Nostalgia. So here you analyze, and this is a quote from the book, a romance with free market economies and the market-oriented state in Amitav Ghosh's In an Antique Land, and how this complicates sort of dominant notions of Indian Ocean cosmopolitanism. So could you speak more about your thoughts on how this term cosmopolitanism continues to represent, for good or ill, a keyword in Indian Ocean studies? And how does that link to the term Afro-Asian, which you use in the subtitle and throughout the book?
Yeah, so now, of course, a lot has been written about cosmopolitanism since I wrote the book. I mean, Anthony Appiah has written on it, and several other people have written on it. So it's a term much under circulation. The point I was trying to make is a point that has been made about modernity earlier, which is to say that, earlier notions of modernity just kind of blindly assumed that modernity equaled westernization, right? So to be modern was to be Western. Now, we know now, and I've hopefully known for a long time, but that there are all kinds of different kinds of modernity and that we don't necessarily all have to march to, Enlightenment norms to be modern. There are different ways of being modern. Same thing with cosmopolitanism. The point I was trying to make is that, kind of the assumption when not all, but when many people use the word cosmopolitanism, the assumption is that here are third world, to use an older nomenclature, non-Western third world folks who are sufficiently cosmopolitan, which means sufficiently acclimatized to the ways of the West. That's how cosmopolitan used to be used, right? So if I can speak English well, as opposed to a fellow Indian who might not speak English, I'm more cosmopolitan than he is. That's a false way of, or wrong way, I think, of looking at cosmopolitanism. In fact, I make that argument in the chapter on the two Indian travelers, where, you know, there's this Parsi gentleman, elite gentleman, who can even pass as white. He's very light skinned, who is, who kind of like assimilates European ways of dining and things like that. And so in that model of thinking about him, one would say, oh, he's very cosmopolitan. He can live in both worlds, Western as well as Indian. I argue that, in fact, you know, by my reckoning, it's the other guy, Adamji, who was very uncomfortable or not very uncomfortable, but you know, was not as comfortable as Sorabji with Europeans, was much more comfortable with Africans and with other Indian Ocean inhabitants. He could speak several, you know, languages of the area. He could trade and do business in that area with ease, without necessarily mastering European languages. I argue that you know, he has a form of what I call, or following Homi Bhabha, what I call a vernacular cosmopolitanism, which is to say that he's much more at ease in the world of the Indian Ocean, than maybe even this westernized Parsi gentleman is. So that's what I was trying to say about, you know, we need to be careful about what we mean by the word cosmopolitan, and not just assume or you know, have this implicit bias, if you will, that cosmopolitanism is necessarily westernization. As far as the term Afrasian is concerned, that is a direct borrowing from Michael Pearson. Michael Pearson uses the word in some of his own work. And it's a form of protest, if you will. It's a form of protest which it's only symbolic. It doesn't go very far. But you know, why is the Indian Ocean called the Indian Ocean? If you look at the vast surf, you know, area that traverses the Indian Ocean, that this vast body of water inhabits, it borders more of Africa than it probably does of India. I mean, India is a tiny little thing up there in the north, or in the middle center north of the Indian Ocean. You know, it encompasses a vast body of terrain, including Africa. Why should we call it why has it been historically called the Indian Ocean? So it is one way of saying, and I continue to use the word Indian Ocean in my book, because nomenclatures are not that easy to dismantle, at least not by one person. But at least for the title of the book, I said, you know, let's appropriate this word of Michael Pearson's Afrasian, which gives at least symbolic acknowledgement to both sides of the Indian Ocean, or at least these two sides. There are other sides of the Indian Ocean further in the east, but, you know, at least these two sides of the Indian Ocean, which was the purview of my book.
Yeah, and I guess the other side of those cosmopolitan and Afrasian connections are the colonial hierarchies that you raise in Chapter 3, which you titled Post-Manichaean Aesthetics, Asian Texts and Lives. So here, this notion of post-Manichaean aesthetics challenges, from the perspective of East African Asian histories, Franz Fanon's famous description of the settler colonial city as starkly divided between settler and native domains, which you've already spoken to a little bit. But could you say a little more about why it's so important to move beyond this binary conception of colonial power, and sort of what do we gain by this ethics of complexity that you discuss, and how does that help us rethink colonialism beyond this binary?
Yeah, so we touched on this a little bit earlier, as you mentioned. You know, East African space in particular was never a binary space. You know, there were always, the Asians preceded the British in Kenya. And you know, they preceded the Germans in Tanganyika. So Asians were always there. The Omani Arabs were always there. Other Arabs were, Hadramati Arabs were there. I mean, so this was a multi-ethnic, multiracial community even before the British or the Germans arrived, right? So in some ways, the notion, yes, it's true that the settlers, especially in the Kenyan colonial highlands, tried to demarcate a space, which was a space between white settlers and everybody else. But the everybody else was also not purely, settler and native domains. There were spaces, marked out for Asians. There were, Asian settlements. There were African settlements. Vasanji does this beautifully when he talks in the Gunny Sack in the context of Dar es Salaam. He talks about how the city was mapped out between white areas, brown areas, and black areas. It's Spinoza's Manichaean binary is a useful one to think with. It gives us a certain kind of clarity, but at the same time, it needs to be nuanced. And, one of the ways in which of late we've seen that happen is through Mamdani's discussion, the ways in which colonialism kind of looked at settlers versus natives and the different kinds of, laws that were structured and put in place for them. And that's what the book tries to do, is to say, look, what does it mean? In fact, I should admit that the book doesn't go far enough. I mean, ideally speaking, I should have given a lot more space to the Arab community, especially in Zanzibar. I've done that elsewhere. I've been doing work on Zanzibar, which looks at the triangulation between Arabs, Indians, Black Africans, and to a lesser extent white folks, because they were not, Zanzibar was not settled in the same way in which colonial Africa, Kenya was. But nevertheless, it a lot more nuance is needed. I had to draw the boundary somewhere. And even though, the Arab presence in Zanzibar comes, a discussion of that comes through in the Gunny Sack novel chapter, I'm not certain that it's sufficient. It should be more. I would have liked to have done more with that. But again, every project has its limits, and those were the limits I set myself.
I'm glad you're following up on that. I'll be looking forward to it. You used the notion of ethics of complexity proposed by Amitav Ghosh, and that is really productive once you take up these different works. In chapter 4, Through Indian Eyes, Travel and the Performance of Ethnicity, this chapter sets out to shed light on the diversity of Indian experience in 20th century East Africa through readings of two relatively unknown narratives by South Asians who traveled to East Africa. Can you tell us how did you come to find and select the analyzed autobiographies, and why is that diversity of experience is so crucial to recognize?
So this is an interesting story. That book that those two narratives were published in was published by the Friends of Fort Jesus. It's a organization in 1997. And I think it was published in a very limited edition. I think 97 or 100 copies or something like that. If you look up WorldCat, at least by my last count, there are only 27 copies of that book available worldwide. Okay, at least through libraries. I mean, people might have them in private libraries and private collections or whatever. But only 27 copies in WorldCat. This is symptomatic of the problems we are dealing with. We mentioned this earlier about publication and author, audience and readership and things like that. How did I come across it? Well, I had come across the work of Cynthia Salvadori, who I mentioned in my acknowledgments as somebody who was a pioneer in this field of working on the lives and histories and biographies of Asians in East Africa. And she unfortunately passed away before I got to know her or meet her or could establish any contact. But I acknowledge her as a pioneer in the field. And she had put together a wonderful volume of three-set volume called We Came in Thaus, which was basically based on interviews and, interviews with a whole bunch of Asians in Kenya, and everything from people who are working on game parks to people who are dukawalas to people who are teachers to what have you, the whole range of people. It came in three volumes, also published in Kenya in 1996 by a publication called Paper Chase, If you look that up in the world in WorldCat, you'll see that there are only 31 copies worldwide available of that book. I don't know how many, what the first publication run was. So here, you see, what happens is I came across those two narratives by happen chance. I knew about Cynthia Salvatore. I had come across this We Came in Thou's book, or the set of three books. And I just looked her up in WorldCat to see what else she had published. And then I came across this book, Two Indian Travelers East Africa. I had not really seen it before. I had not seen any citations really of significance that I knew of at that point, although there's been some work done on it subsequently. Same thing with the book by Nanji Kalidas Mehta, Dream Half Expressed, which was published originally in 1966. If you look that up, there's 28 copies of it worldwide. I think Google Books now may have a version of it on Google Books, but, you know, Google Books is relatively new. So the point I'm trying to make here is that part of the research process was just uncovering and discovering narratives that should be, and have been to me at least, of real historical interest about lives of people who have just been forgotten, have not been part of our mainstream thinking about African identities or the history of East Africa. And so that's how, you know, that's how I found that book. Why is the diversity so crucial to recognize? Let me talk about a different kind of diversity here, and which relates back to an earlier question that you had asked about liberalism and neoliberalism and capitalism and things like that. When I set out to write this book, one of the things I said to myself was that I want to go follow the evidence wherever the evidence leads, right? I'm not going to be interested in only good actors and bad actors. I mean, only talking about good actors or the people that we like to talk about. I want to be able to talk about everyone, because that's how you study something. You don't just pick and choose, you know, between people you like and people you don't like. You do what you have to do. You go with the evidence. And this was actually, I'm afraid to say, and I know that many of my colleagues will not like me saying it, but I'll say it anyway. This was against the grain of a certain version of postcolonial studies, which only sought to seek the subaltern, right? Everyone was looking for the voice of the subaltern. And in many ways, some of the people I look at are subaltern, but in many ways, they are not. Nanji Kalidas Mehta and some of the three people, entrepreneurs that I write about in that chapter, were very rich, wealthy, influential people in their societies. They were businessmen. They were, you know, they were privileged. But I said to myself, should we therefore just like exclude them from the history because they're not the cool guys who we want to like focus on? No, that's not good postcolonial studies. Postcolonial studies looks at both the elites as well as the underprivileged. And so that's where my evidence led me. And I think that's, frankly, I think, you know, talking about diversity, I think that's why those, partly they have not been looked at because their books have just not been available, but partly they've not been looked at because they don't accord with certain kinds of postcolonial frameworks that are skeptical of businessmen and men of commerce. And that's what I was trying to say. Look, what might these men of commerce have to teach us or tell us about the complexities of colonialism, and maybe even complexities
Yeah, I'm glad that you raised some of these political and disciplinary implications of the project, because I did want to follow up on some of those, especially in relation to the next chapter, actually, chapter 5, Commerce as Romance, Mehta, Madhvani, and Manji, which here you do talk about that that focus on the romance of the Indian Ocean and especially commerce in the Indian Ocean, which I read as implicitly a critique of, again, that cosmopolitan Indian Ocean imaginary and how it's sometimes presented as a critique, a sort of presentist critique of contemporary neoliberal globalization, you know, the Amitav Ghosh model of cosmopolitanism versus present globalization. Do you think this is a fair reading of that theoretical intervention of the book as a whole?
So what I was trying to do in that chapter was I was trying to lay out what these businessmen saw as, if you will, their own charter in East Africa. And that was to, when I say, you know, Manji is the one that most explicitly articulates it, the notion of commerce as romance. which is to say that they felt, whether rightly or wrongly, we can judge, but they felt that they were distinct. They wanted to distinguish themselves from the British colonials. They said, the British came here to steal your land. The British came here to exploit you. The British came here to rule over you. We, on the other hand, have not come to take over your land. We, on the other hand, have not come over to take to, you know, rule over you politically. We have come as, again, we can critique this, but this is the charter that they put out for themselves. We have come as equal partners in a trade exchange. You have things to trade with us. We have things to trade with you. We can do that amicably. We can do that equally. And our relationship is a romance. It is not exploitation. Now, as I say, as I repeatedly say, you know, we can question that, but that's the way in which they imagined themselves. And many of them, you know, I must say, especially the ones who became, you know, like large, you know, large corporations, the Mehta family, the Madhavani family, really did think of themselves as being, you know, we talk about now about corporate responsibility and things like that. They really did think that it was their job not only to employ folks, you know, in their various factories and whatnot, but to provide for them, not just in terms of pay, salary, but to create for them structures that they thought the colonial government was not adequately providing, such as good schooling for their kids, such as good housing, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of these towns in which they established their companies became kind of like corporate towns in which they built housing, they built schools, they built, you know, other infrastructure that they felt that the British colonial government was not providing. Now, we don't have to, you know, praise them for it or, you know, or whatever, but that's what was, that was their way of thinking about it. And so that's what I was trying to highlight in that particular chapter. In terms of you know, neoliberalism or capitalism, you know, I think most of these folks, other than one of them who actually benefited from state intervention, and protectionism, most of them were free market guys. If they were alive today, and if you had wanted to engage with them about globalization, neoliberalism, my hunch is, I may be wrong, but my hunch is that they would have no issues with capitalism, and neoliberalism, for better or for worse. They were not critiques of that system. As I say, even in Amitav Ghosh's In an Antique Land, we see that in his later work in the Ibis trilogy, and I know we might be able to talk about it depending on how much time we have. But I know that, he has become more critical about that whole market ideology system, that the British used with the Opium War and all of that. But In an Antique Land still has that liberal, kind of sensibility at work, I think, in my reading.
Yeah. And so then in chapter 6, you sort of follow up on some the post-colonial implications of some of these colonial era East African dynamics that you were just speaking to. The title is Lighting a Candle on Mount Kilimanjaro, Partnering with Nyerere. So a large focus of the chapter is on Sophia Mustafa, who was the Asian leader of the Tanganyika African National Union. And so I wanted to ask specifically a few questions about her legacy. What do you feel is the legacy of Mustafa's politics of non-racialism today? And how do you see her political writings offering insights on questions regarding the relationship of political citizenship to decolonization and or notions of post-coloniality?
Yeah, Sophia Mustafa was a very, very important and crucial figure at the moment of independence, and she really was a genuine partner in Nyerere's kind of efforts at creating a non-racialist state. Nyerere was exemplary in this. I mean, he really, in fact, he upset some of his fellow Black African leaders because he drew a hard line on this. As far as he was concerned, if you were a citizen, you were a citizen. It didn't matter what race you were, whether you were Black, Brown, White, whatever. You know, you were going to be treated equally, and that was it. That was a non-racial state. And Sophia Mustafa, as well as some of the other Asians I mentioned, partnered with him on it because they felt that even though he had put in measures that disenfranchise them economically, which he did, rent controls and all kinds of things that were necessary to do. He had a socialist agenda, and he did according to that socialist agenda, but he didn't do it in a targeted racial way, and they appreciated that. Mustafa was also very interesting and important because not only was she Asian, she was a woman. And as I talk about in the chapter, she had to deal with what that meant, both within the Asian community, but also the nation at large. You know, at the nation that was not used to having Asian women, in positions of leadership. Legacy of Mustafa, I would say, is divided. I mean, when I was growing up in East Africa, which was when I was in high school in the 80s, race relations were the tone was still the tone that had been set by Nyerere. There was a lot more conversation and dialogue, which, to the best of my knowledge, from what I've seen, has not been the case of late. I think there have been more tensions. I think there have been more conflict, at least in the Tanzanian space, and more divisions than I remember as a teenager. Maybe that's just my youth and my nostalgia and my inability to see those tensions when I was a younger man, maybe. But in my visits that I've been to, I found the various communities having more difficulty in having the kind of dialogues that Nyerere encouraged. I would like to be told I'm wrong. I really would. I would like to be told that was just my years in America that have biased me in reading race relations in ways that are not warranted in the Tanzanian context. Perhaps. I would love to know that I'm wrong, but that's my assessment.
Well, those tensions certainly come to the fore in the next chapter, chapter 7, Anti-Asianism and the Politics of Dissent, M.G. Vasanji's The Gunny Sack. So here is your reading of Vasanji's The Gunny Sack as a critique of African socialism in Tanzania, which goes against the grain of, I think, much of what's been written about the novel, which sort of tends to be described as an expression of that kind of generic post-colonial multiculturalism that was announced, I think, I find it kind of hilarious, the Heinemann marketing right on the front cover, Africa's answer to Midnight's Children, right? So it's announced as this answer to Rushdie, which it really wasn't. But could you say more about the importance of the specific context of African socialism that you're bringing to the reading of the novel for either this novel or thinking about East African Asian literature in a larger sense?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I too was caught up in that whole multicultural, Africa's answer to Midnight's Children. That's how I read the novel when I first read it. I have to admit, that's how I read it. In the early 90s, I think it was published in 89. But I think, when it was first published, that's how we all read it, I think. But I will tell you this. It's taken me years of reading that novel and teaching that novel to come to the reading of it that I have in this book, about it being not really, even though it's all about the Asian condition, and it's all about race relations, and it's all about the genealogy of Asians in Tanzania and et cetera, in East Africa, that really the heart of its critique is not so much the Asian condition vis-a-vis racial politics, but rather political politics, if you will, the socialist condition versus, what you saw in something like neighboring Kenya, which was, not socialist by any means. I will tell you this, when we moved as a family from Nairobi to Dar es Salaam, so let me just begin with affect here, right? When we moved from Nairobi to Dar es Salaam, as a teenager, I could visibly, palpably feel the difference. Nairobi was what I imagined, because I had never been to the West before. Nairobi was what I imagined the West and capitalism to be. There were large grocery stores, supermarkets, everything that you imagine, that assumes a kind of capitalist orientation was what I experienced in Nairobi. When I went to Dar es Salaam, it was very, very different. You know, unlike in Nairobi, where, you know, the elites could basically, you know, call the shots. You know, if you needed something, you got it, because you could use influence and power. That was not the case necessarily in Dar es Salaam. I remember my father talking about corporate types. My father was a manager of a factory that, you know, produced utensils, you know, like stock pots and, you know, what we call sufurias in East Africa, right? Basic vessels to cook it. And I remember once walking into his office, and there was a whole line of people on the day on which the factory was allowed to sell, because they weren't allowed to sell every day. There was, like, I think it was only on Friday between certain hours that the state let them sell to the general public. Everything else had to be basically sold to the state, and then the state distributed it, right? But I remember on one of those Fridays walking to my dad's office, and there was a whole line of people outside waiting to buy whatever it is that they wanted to buy. And amongst those people was a guy who I later found out was a minister. He was a minister, right, on the cabinet. And I was like, wow, Dad, I mean, this guy is waiting in line to get to buy a sufuria. And he said, yeah, that's the way Tanzania works. It's not Kenya. Okay. So on a pure level of affect, it really influenced me. I looked up to Nyerere. I said, wow, this is a really truly egalitarian society. This is a society in which just because you happen to be a minister doesn't mean that you're going to get what you want, you know, et cetera. Socialism in Tanzania was a huge experiment. It was, you know, people like Walter Rodney came to the university. You know, it was the high hope for everyone, at that moment. And I, even as a teenager, even though I arrived late after that big moment when Rodney and the others were at the University of Dar es Salaam, Issa Shivji continued to be there, of course. But, you know, even though I had arrived later after the high point of socialist hope, I could still feel it. We could feel it in the air. There was hope. There was, even though we had to stand in lines for basic commodities like bread and milk, there was still hope that we were forging towards an egalitarian society, that this was not going to be a society with the haves and the have-nots. Maybe it was all going to be have-nots, but at least that was better than some who had the haves and some who had the have-nots. So anyway, there was a lot of hope. And I continued to bear that hope. I wept the day Nyerere died, right? I continued to look up to Nyerere and look up to his ideal of a non-racialist, socialist society way until, you know, my old age. And I still do. I mean, I still think there was real merit in what Nyerere was trying to accomplish. But what Basenji's novel does is it tries to portray the people who are negatively affected by it. And it tries to foreground their resentment. Now, it's not a resentment that I necessarily share personally, but then again, I didn't lose anything. I didn't lose all my property. I didn't lose the ability to leave. I didn't, you know, so I was not affected negatively in the way in which some of the people, characters that he portrays in that novel, lost. The important point that, as I say, it took me several readings and teachings of that novel to recognize is that the main character who leaves the novel leaves not as a racial or ethnic refugee, but as a political refugee. He's worried about Nyerere's state, shutting him down. And that did happen in Nyerere's time. If you talk to people in Zanzibar, for instance, who lived through that experience, they will tell you about the mass detentions that were taking place under Nyerere's regime. So it was not all as happy for everyone as I believed as a young, innocent teenager. And that's what the novel tries to show.
Thanks. So in line with the open-ended nature of the final chapter, which is a coda titled Entangled Lives, I wanted to ask a more open-ended question. So the book ends, the final paragraph, by aligning with Paul Gilroy's project, and this is a quote from Gilroy, imagining political culture beyond the color line. So given this concluding appeal to such a prominent and influential theorist of the Black Atlantic, I wonder whether, moving forward, you find opportunities for greater crosstalk between Atlantic and Indian Ocean studies.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question, and I've been working on that. In fact, my current project, which I may or may not be able to complete since I've just been appointed chair of the department, so I don't know how much how much time I'm going to have with it. But it really does do exactly that. It tries to forge a link between the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean. There's a preview of this in a in an article I published in the PMLA a few years ago called Oceans Connect, in which I look at the relationships between Salem in Massachusetts, Salem, Massachusetts, and Zanzibar. You know, because there was a vibrant trade between North America, the United States, and Zanzibar in the 19th century. Jeremy Presthold has written on it. Others have written on it. And again, here too, I'll just say, I don't know how much time we've got left, but here too, I'll just say that, you know, there were scholars working on that, those issues in the 70s and 80s, but much of their work is forgotten. And now it's only now that it's being revived again, which is to say work on the connections between North America, United States in particular, and East Africa. I just published a very short piece in an online journal looking at the ivory trade. You know, a ton of ivory was brought from East Africa to North America to make piano keys. Right? If you think about the number of elephants that were killed, and if you think about the number of human beings who suffered in East Africa because those ivory tusks were oftentimes, you know, procured in the in the internal regions of East Africa and brought to the shore, to the coast, by slaves, by people who had been enslaved. And it was a miserable, miserable journey from the interior to the exterior, you know, being shackled, but also having these iron, these heavy ivory tusks to carry all the way to the coast. Several people died. Staggering numbers of people died in this. And this was all in order so that we could have middle class families in North America and Europe. But in this case, I'm thinking of North America, could have beautifully polished ivory trees, keys for their pianos. There's a town in Connecticut called Ivoryton, Ivoryton, Connecticut, which is named after ivory because it was one of the main places where ivory was being imported and turned into piano keys, amongst others. So I've been doing some reading. I spent last summer doing some research in Ivoryton, and hopefully someday I'll be able to do more on that.
Thank you. And thank you for writing this beautiful book. And I really enjoyed reading it. And I would like the readers to have a sense of that. If you can share with us a paragraph.
So, you know, what I think I'll read is it's a paragraph that raises questions that I think might be useful for your readers in case they are tempted to read the book. They might find this paragraph useful. So I'll just read it. Okay. And it kind of begins mid-sentence, so to speak, so please forgive me for that, but I think ultimately, I think hopefully it'll be useful. So, to ask the question of what might connect the worlds and the worldviews of the Tunisian-Egyptian merchant Benny Jew and the Ugandan exile Jay, or for that matter, the Indian slave woman Ashu, most likely abandoned by Benny Jew on the Malabar coast in the 12th century, and Bibi Taratibu, the African slave woman abandoned in the 19th century by the Indian Tanji Govindji, in M.G. Vasanji's The Gunny Sack, is to ask a series of questions that are at the heart of this book. What are the possibilities of cross-racial relationships in contexts of structurally unequal exchange? What is the nature of cross-racial intimacy, and how is it negotiated in times of crisis? What is the relationship between the state and the performance of identity? How do notions of citizenship and civic responsibility affect the ways in which individuals tell stories to themselves and to others about their lives? What is the role of ethnic identification in the fashioning of meaningful lives? How do market forces and economic status mediate interpersonal and inter-ethnic relationships? How do societies that are in transition negotiate the demands of economic justice and human rights? What is the role of cultural and/or religious toleration in the making of social stability? What are the limits of cultural exchange, and how do we recognize the difference between relatively equal exchanges on the one hand and forced impositions on the other? What are the ideal conditions for human solidarities? How do individuals with recognizably different affiliations reach out to create productive affiliations? what are the most productive and meaningful ways in which societies incorporate strangers, outsiders, foreigners? How should we adjudicate between the rightful entitlements of indigeneity and the weighty politics of migration and diaspora? How and under what conditions do settlers become natives? So I can't promise that I have all the answers to those questions in this book, but at least that's what I was trying to ask.
Thank you. And I definitely say I see a need for this book to be an audiobook, to be honest. It's really beautifully written. Well, Gaurav, we've taken a lot of your time, and I know you have published since Commerce with the Universe a number of works. One is co-edited volume titled Critical Terms for the Study of Africa, published by Chicago Press in 2018, and Approaches to Teaching the Works of Amitav Ghosh, published in 2018. Can you briefly introduce these two works?
The Approaches to Teaching the Works of Amitav Ghosh, emerged as part of a MLA volume on, they have a series on options for teaching, approaches to teaching world literatures, rather. And so they were asking me, and they wanted to expand that series to include more Anglophone writers. And they asked me who would be a good writer. And I said, clearly Amitav Ghosh. And he's, in my mind, he's one of the most innovative and interesting English language writing authors. Writing right now. And I like him. This takes us back to the question that you asked earlier. I think I'm attracted to his work because it does, consciously engage with historical work, anthropological work. He goes to places to, and interviews people, et cetera, et cetera. So I like that blend. It's not to everyone's taste. I know that Ghosh has been criticized for being so to speak, too scholarly in his writings. People say, he's just giving us a history lesson. There's not enough fiction here. Well, that's fine. I mean, that may not be to other people's taste, but it's to my taste. So I really enjoyed working on that book. And it has a whole series of essays by colleagues who teach Amitav Ghosh in a variety of institutional contexts and in a variety of settings, undergraduate classes, graduate classes, etc. So I hope that will be of use to folks. And then the Critical Terms for the Study of Africa is actually a project that I had thought of almost 20 years ago when I was in graduate school, or 20, I don't know how long that was, but yeah, maybe 20 years ago. And I was supposed to, I thought, it's based on the volume on critical terms for literary studies that was very, very popular and useful to us as graduate students back in the day. It came out of University of Chicago Press. And then subsequently, several other volumes have come out, critical terms for the study of religion and Buddhism and gender and others. And I thought, hey, we need to have something like this for Africa. We have not, there's not something comparable. So that's what we did. We, brought together a team of scholars, junior as well as senior, to come up with a set of terms that we thought would be of interest and use to both, students, beginning study of African studies, as well as established scholars who might want to refresh their, refresh their take on some of these concepts.
Since you've raised Ghosh's work again, I wonder if I might sneak in one more question that links back to the Antique Land chapter. I wonder whether you feel that some of Ghosh's more recent ocean fiction, I'm thinking in particular of the Ibis trilogy, which I think has a pretty explicit critique of those liberal free trade justifications for British intervention in the Opium Wars. I wonder if that addresses, or some of that work addresses the free market romance that you found in An Antique Land.
I think it does. It very much does. But I will say this again, because I feel this about Ghosh, whose work, as you can tell, no one spends a year of their life reading and writing on an author who one doesn't like and admire. So, I say everything I say with that caveat. But I will say this. Ghosh has always been critical of free market market ideology and et cetera, when it comes to colonial British or Portuguese intervention. He was that with In an Antique Land as well. So it's no surprise that he finds British intervention in the Opium Wars and its connection to free market liberalism critical, and that he's critical of it. I'm not surprised by that, right? I think where Ghosh's romance comes in is when he looks at networks of commerce within non-Western spaces, which may have been enabling for those people. that's where I think the Inanitic Land, kind of romanticizes Benhiju and, Boma and the other traders, right? So whether he's able and willing to write, let's say, another text that has the same kind of critique of market economics that he has in Ibis Trilogy, but does not involve non-Western actors, I'd wait and see.
Great. So then finally, what are you working on now? Can you tell us about your current and future projects and or what you hope to work on?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm trying to follow up on this work on the Indian Ocean and Atlantic connections. Some of it has been, kind of delayed because of access to archives and just time. I've just been appointed chair of the department, so just time to do the work is an issue. And then I'm also working on a different project that is not related to the Indian Ocean, which has to do with the history of the profession of literary studies and looking at at professional issues and the development of the profession. But, as I say, this first book of this first project that I mentioned, which connects with the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean, is really meant to be kind of a bridge between commerce with the universe and some of the work that I've been doing on Salem, Ivoryton. And it probably will, again, as I said earlier, every project needs to have some limits. I think that the limit on that project is going to be demarcated by Zanzibar. So in other words, it will be looking at connections with the Atlantic world and in the Indian Ocean world, but from within kind of a Zanzibari rubric, if you will. So that's the plan.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's episode in which we explored Commerce with the Universe, Africa, India, and the Afro-Asian Imagination, published by Columbia University Press in 2013. This is your host, Ahmed Elmazmi.
And I'm Michael Ramore.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.